I'd like to begin with something I did really quite a while ago. So I mentioned in the first session I divided between doing and thinking about doing and thinking about what ought to be done. And so I do, and then if I'm lucky I find time to stop and write for a while. And whereas now I'm working on a political spirituality, that is to say a theology and spirituality that rises out of our political life, our life together working for justice. Or I think of it, it's subtitled as a liturgy for our life together, that is our common work celebrated as a religious exercise. In any case, some years ago, in the early 70s, or it started in graduate school maybe, where one of the professors that I had, a person well known to Al Pitcher, who by the way was my dissertation advisor for those, I don't know if he wants credit or blame, whether I should mention that or not.
We'll see.
Yes. Yes. He'll write and have them take the degree back, you know. See, didn't pass the last oral. I remember at the time that my impression of what you were doing, Al, in the late 60s was that as much as anything, you were busy being an activist with the movement, trying to help Jesse Jackson get started with Operation Breadbasket, and then trying to create a white movement that would parallel the black movement. Breadbasket was not entirely, but largely black. And after the King assassination, it refined somewhat further for a while. But that kind of division between activism and, meanwhile, I was in a program for social ethics, which is a highly intellectual program. Didn't in itself have any activist elements. And we were concerned about, you know, what ought we to do? And there was this one faculty member in the philosophy department who felt that the answer to that was a kind of rational answer, that if you could provide a convincing, rational answer, that presumably then people would go about doing what they ought to do. But it was my observation that in seminaries, faculty who talked about theology, supposedly theology was derived from ethics, they said, but faculty who did theology didn't seem to be any more ethical than anybody else. People said, well, if you study the Bible, you will be more ethical or you'll be moved to justice, but I didn't see that people who taught Bible were moved to work for justice, by and large. There were some, but they were always a minority. And mostly the ones that I was around were led to write another article about biblical scholarship, rather than to have their texts. Their texts didn't seem to move them. They always thought that they would talk about the texts and they would teach seminary students about the texts, and then the seminary students would go out and work for justice. Well, by and large, it was my experience that the seminary students learned their professors' lessons. And that was that justice is a word you talk about rather than an activity you do. And so they went into their parishes and preached about justice, and then they wondered why nobody did anything. And the reason nobody did anything was because nobody was doing anything up and down the line anywhere. They were all just talking about doing something. I began to be wondering about, you know, what is it? I was teaching in seminary by then, and how do I get these students, uprooted from some of their cultural stuff? And how do you get them to become socially aware? Here you are, and you're in Texas, and how do you get these people to become socially aware, and how do you get them out there to actual involvement? And I had this as just sort of a background question, but it's one of those things you wonder about, but you don't pursue in any particularly active way. And then I invited a guy who lived two blocks over from me. I discovered that John Howard Griffin lived two blocks over from my house. Now, you may not remember John Howard Griffin's name, but you may remember the book Black Like Me. John Howard Griffin is the newspaper man who in the, I believe it was the 50s or so, that turned his skin black by x-ray treatments and so forth, and he traveled through the South as a white person but identified as black to see what reality was for black people. Now, in a way, this was tragic and unnecessary and sad, and it shouldn't have had to happen because black people had been saying what black reality was for a long time and white people weren't listening. I mean, in a way, it's kind of sad that a white person has to become black for people to listen, you know, or pay attention. Nonetheless, he performed a kind of service, and the way things maybe ought to be isn't always the way they are, and a lot of people heard him who did not hear other voices. And when I found out that John Howard Griffin was a neighbor, I thought, well, heck, let's have him come over and speak to one of my classes and we'll see what he has to say for himself. Well, one of the students asked him why he had changed his skin black and done what he had done, because it was fairly risky and so forth. He was sort of at risk all the way along the line. And fortunately, another student had had the presence of mind to have a tape recorder running. I went back, got his answer from the tape, got his permission to use it, and it's that story. Why did I, John Howard Griffin, turn my skin black and travel in the South? This is his answer to that story that got me going on some research then. Well, hey, this is what got him going. What gets other people going? What gets other people to become kind of morally aware and politically involved? And then what I'm hoping to do is, after I tell you some of the things that I thought I had discovered, was for us to share amongst ourselves, and you can add too, you know, what is it that helped you become socially aware, morally aware? What is it that has helped you become politically involved? But first, John Howard Griffin's story. He said, I was born of an old Southern fundamentalist family from Georgia. I had the kind of upbringing that society gave us those early years, which gave us the illusion that we didn't have a prejudiced bone in our body. We barely learned to hate. I was very unhappy with the educational system in this country, and when I was 16, I went to France. I was there until France fell. So now you're in the 1930s, okay? I was in the French underground smuggling Jewish people out of Germany from 1939 to 1940, and that was, of course, the first real awakening. I'm going to come back and talk about the metaphors in here eventually. Metaphors are powerful indicators of states of consciousness. He has an awakening experience. That was the first real awakening that I had to what racism was all about. It was a devastating shock to me to find that our preoccupation with the Hitler rationale had been merely intellectual. I am ashamed to say that I made no connection between the reasoning that we did, where Jewish people were the victim group, and the same kind of reasoning I had been brought up with concerning a different victim group, the black people. It was a tremendous kind of shock. I'm going to come back to that, shock. He says it was a devastating shock. Metaphor language again, shock. It hit me. It jarred me. It threw me off course. It was a tremendous kind of shock to me because we were intellectually discussing the great intellectual preoccupation of students in France just prior to the beginning of World War II. And we argued the pros and the cons of the great change. Imagine that you're in France and you're arguing the pros and cons of Nazism. But we do that all the time. We do that all the time. It's just not Nazism. I think the eye-opener metaphor, eye-opener, awakening, eye-opener. I think the eye-opener was the night just before the fall of France. We had managed to get quite a few Jewish persons out of Germany and put them on boats to England. This time, we had to have special kinds of papers to move any more over the age of 15. So we were caught with these families and no way to get them farther. I was only one of two people in this area who was doing this kind of work. It was my task for this night to go and tell them that we were not going to succeed. We didn't have any skills at forging papers. It was going into those rooms where we had them hidden that the whole thing, which has haunted me ever since in my work in this country, hit me square in the face. Hit me square in the face. Okay. Jolt, shock, devastating hit. Hit me square in the face. I went into the room where the mothers and fathers and children were hidden. I didn't have to tell a single one of those families they were not going to succeed. They looked at us and they told us that it was all over. They said the first thing the Germans would do is round them up and ship them back to Germany. Then they asked me to do a heartbreaking thing. They asked me to take their children because we could move children under the age of 15. And suddenly you were sitting in those rooms. He switches tense from past to present, or present perfect. And suddenly you were sitting in those rooms. It becomes more real to him, and he throws himself and his imagination back into that moment. And suddenly you were sitting in those rooms, and you became aware of the fact that there are only two people in the world that knew who was in those rooms, myself and my teammate. Suddenly, all this intellectual preoccupation we had was simply washed away because we were in the presence of a massive human tragedy. The tragedy of parents who loved their children and were giving their children away to someone they hardly knew so that at least the children would escape the camp. And I realized that I could go outside of those rooms and I would go a block in any direction and could find a person who considered himself perfectly decent, who had no idea of the reality inside those rooms. He might begin to rationalize and justify the racism which led to the tragedy in those rooms. I have often in talks in this country wished that I could take people in such rooms. Because after Black Like Me, I became one of the few people who could circulate into the South and be completely hidden by black people. And so it became my task, along with many other blacks, to investigate the tragedy that was committed against black people. It was done thus. One might be picked up and taken into Mississippi by black people and stay in the homes of black people in the day and travel at night so he wouldn't be seen. You are constantly in the presence of the same kind of massive human tragedy in the homes where young people had been murdered. One instance was where an 8-year-old child had a rope thrown at her by some men who were trying to frighten her. It was thrown around her neck, and she was dragged 2 blocks behind the car. This kind of thing was going on in that situation constantly. We were documenting all of this from the point of view of black people rather than take the opinion of whites in those communities who seemed not to know about the situation or lied about it, or did not investigate it. And in those experiences, I was right back in those same kinds of rooms, rooms that were filled with grief-torn human beings. And when you go outside those rooms, you know that you can encounter people everywhere who consider themselves decent, who would go right on rationalizing the racism which led to the tragedy inside those rooms. I wanted to call the book Inside the Rooms, but the publisher said Up From Apathy had a better chance of selling a book. It's a powerful story. It's a powerful story, I think. It was a powerful experience for him. So what that led me to do then was to interview 87 people, black, white, Mexican American, male, female, attorneys, full-time social activists, people who worked in soup kitchens and urban ministries. A couple of the people I interviewed are big names, but I didn't use anybody's names, so I can't identify, guarantee everybody anonymity, but you would recognize the names of some of the people if you heard them. Some of them are people who work 9 to 5 at General Dynamics, making fighter planes, and in the evenings and weekends were working on social justice. So they weren't all full-time activists. Some were people who would just, as they could work it in around their schedule, would do whatever they could to work for justice. And along with that, I read a bunch of autobiographies. Of course, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King Jr., Margaret Sanger, Angela Davis, Pancho Villa, the autobiography of Jose Vasconcelos. When you're in Texas, you're always attuned somewhat to Hispanic reality as well as black reality, at least you try to be. And then wrote this Up From Apathy, which among the people that I thank in it is a fellow by the name of Pitcher. I don't know what became of him. I don't know where he went or what became of him, but he was a nice guy. Anyhow, I guess some of you haven't met him. That's the guy sitting over there. I forget that not everybody has had a chance to meet Al Pitcher here. So anyhow, interviewed these people and came up basically with two moments in the whole thing. Awareness and activation. That is to say, what is it that leads people to become socially aware? But there's a lot of people out there that are aware, right? But they don't do anything. So it seemed to me that was a separate kind of thing. Okay? But starting first with awareness. What are the experiences that people have? And I would ask you to think, not just listen to me, but think about your own experiences. Okay? Because I don't begin to believe that in interviewing 87 people, you know, I have a comprehensive view of this thing. I just opened a few little windows, at least for myself, so that I could understand a little better. Basically, when I do research and writing, I do it for myself because I want to know something. And that's why, again, political spirituality, I don't know if there's any market for it, but market is not the standard that I use to decide what it is I'm going to work on. It's just that I have something I can't figure out and I need to figure it out. What experiences do people have that lead them to become socially and politically aware? Well, one, and the most obvious one, is the experience of discrimination. Okay? Of one kind or another. It can be more or less severe. I mean, people talked about, you know, black people talked about, you know, the two drinking fountains and trying to get a job and not being able to get a job, or getting a college education and winding up sweeping the floor, all those kinds of things that you're readily familiar with. But the experience of discrimination, the experience of suffering, but not just suffering, but preventable suffering. We all suffer. But preventable suffering that is socially, I've got this all backwards now, socially caused
preventable suffering.
As to say, it's because, it's not just because, a volcano erupted somewhere, but because society had constructed itself in destructive kinds of ways. That's pretty obvious. A second one that's pretty obvious is seeing other people suffer. Probably the best part of the manuscript is the stories, because it has a lot of the stories in it that talk about the experience, the specific experiences that people had. But you go somewhere and you see one story that I remember is this: these people were in India and they're riding a train. They're going somewhere. All of a sudden, the train stopped. And I said, what's the problem? People kind of get out and they look and all this kind of stuff. Well, there was a guy up ahead who was so desperate and so hungry that he went up and he put his neck on the train track. He decided he would rather be dead than slowly starve and watch his family starve. So the experience of watching, or in some secondhand way, or sometimes just from reading a book. I don't know. For me, reading the autobiography of Malcolm X was one of those memorable things in my life, that I will never forget. I don't remember all the book by any good means, but it was very, very powerful, his experience of the various experiences that he went through. Another one is, and I don't know exactly how to call this, let's say bonding with. There's a kind of awareness experience that comes out of bonding with. What do I mean? Well, the best way is just to read. That's a real short one. It's a guy who later became a full-time activist, but at that point was not. We had this program for Appalachian children. Every Saturday we'd drive a van, pick up the children, and bring them to the college. It was mostly recreation, tutorial, making friends with the kids, or whatever. Well, I really got into that. I really liked those children. And I became close to a few families, bonding with. He got close to these Appalachian kids. Essentially, that's what it comes down to. I was even invited over one night for coon. They had 8 children, lived up in the hills. The father had been a coal miner in shaft mines. The strip mine laid him off. They had been on welfare for a lot of years. They had at one time 13 children, but 5 were killed in a fire. So that working with that kind of children, talking with them and playing with them, made a big impact. I once had to walk up to their school to make an announcement about a picnic, and some of the kids were outside for gym class, and they just started screaming and shouting and all gathered around me, and the kids started to shout out the windows, "There's Ben! There's Ben!" Obviously not his real name, or there wouldn't be any anonymity. It was real neat. I really got close to a lot of people from a poverty setting. One of the things that moved me was that they had to be so mature to survive. Little boys could hunt. The 11-year-old boys were making out and stealing. They stole me an orange one day from the store. They stole them one, so they stole me one too. We just developed close rapport with them when they'd share these kinds of things. We'd get angry at them. One day a little boy took off, decided he was mad at us for some reason, and he just took off, and he was going home, and he just took off running through the woods, and I took off after him and chased him a long time. Finally I caught him, I grabbed him, and I held him, and we just sat there and held each other, and I cried over this kid many nights. At the same time in class, we were reading Bultmann and Bonhoeffer. So, just that sense that this person who otherwise might be an alien to you. I mean, I'm an alien to most of you. I mean, not so much, because I look a lot like the rest of you and so forth, but with all due respect. well, okay, someday, just wait, someday. but you don't know me. You don't know. You don't know what joys I carry in my heart or what hurts I've carried. And I don't know you. I don't know what joys you've experienced or what hurts, what deep scars you may have in your heart somewhere. we are all in some sense just by the fact of being individuals. It's a kind of tragedy built into the human condition that we are individuals and yet we are social beings. We are combined together. But that bonding with someone and knowing that when they hurt just as much as when you hurt. The capacity for empathy. The capacity to realize, I don't know, it used to drive me, I don't know, maybe I've mellowed, I guess I have, that's probably good, but it used to drive me fairly crazy. I would sit in my seminary office, and I'd be sitting there, and, you know, everybody would be nice and good and all that kind of stuff. And I would know that right that very minute, some child was dying because they didn't have half the food I was going to eat for lunch that day. And it used to just drive me nuts. I mean, that kind of imaginative empathy that reaches out either where there are people or at least people that you know in principle are there. Well, anyhow, I could go on about that. And then finally, a fourth one is that I found was confrontation with oneself. And this is a kind of values clarification thing, what it's really like. The story, the particular story is a guy that was teaching high school, and it was during the early days of the 60s and so forth, and there were some riots and schools and this and that, and one time the school, no, it couldn't have been early 60s, it would have had to have been mid 60s, because Vietnam was already an item, mid to late 60s. Anyhow, he was teaching high school in Kansas, I think, and there was a possible riot situation in this predominantly black high school, and so they closed school for the day. And so he's a teacher there, and he's driving home. And as he's driving home, he hears this helicopter report, news report. And they're tracking these kids. The kids have kind of fanned out, and they're not actually doing any damage, and they never did do any damage. Nonetheless, there was a big fear, you know. And these kids are fanning out, and he's driving home, and he's listening to this report from this helicopter about these kids fanning out. And he says to himself, man, he says, I wish they had machine guns up there in that copter. They would just mow them down and then that would solve the problem. And all of a sudden he said, my God, what am I saying? You know, who am I? And I teach these kids. How could I think that? How could I say that? You know, and it was just a sudden confrontation. You know, we all are two or three people inside. And we're all many people. And it was a confrontation of his good part. You know, his good values. I like these kids. I teach these kids. I chose to teach in this high school with his bad part, that deep latent racism, you know, and violence that was somehow... And he had seen the helicopters in Vietnam, you know. He had seen those images on the news. And he sort of got this image from this helicopter and he could see somebody up there with one of these whatever they are guns and so forth. So that was just a kind of internal exchange between him, parts of himself. What are some of the things that have led you to become socially, politically aware? Experiences? I'm going to talk later about people. Let's not talk about people just yet. But have any of you had experiences that you could, that have to be kind of brief because the time, you know, here is fairly finite, but if you could describe a brief experience. Doesn't have to fit any of these categories. I don't have any investment in it coming out the way I thought it was supposed to come out.
My very specific one that took place when I was in high school, probably the first time that true racism caught me, which was when I was down in New Orleans and had gone with the youth group down to the Lutheran Youth Convention down there. The leader had broken her toe, her big toe or something, and I was chosen to go with her to the hospital there, kind of general hospital in the middle of New Orleans. And we walked through the halls. They did the admission on us, on her, and swept us right through. And as we walked down the hall, or she was in this wheelchair going to go have her toe x-rayed, we went by just rows of black folks sitting on the floor. Some of them had their head wrapped, blood, you know, filling the bandages and so on. And the realization that because our skin was white, we were going to have a big toe x-ray, and someone else in a life-threatening situation was waiting for 10 hours to have their head x-rayed.
That contrast, it's the contrast, that moment of contrast between the two realities. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you. How about someone else? Yeah.
When I was in high school, I lived in Japan for a year. Just the experience of being in a different culture where I looked different, and I eventually realized that I would never thing. I would never be good enough, I would never learn enough, I would never measure up, that there were some people that would never accept me no matter how hard I tried.
And you took that and turned that around and realized that there are people in our culture for whom that was true.
It flashes through my mind a lot over the years since.
Yeah.
Just thought of it. I hadn't really thought of this for a long time, but I was in Vietnam and in a non-military position, and I was visiting a city, never been there before, Quy Nhon, and I was walking down the street, and because I was American, some little kids, probably between 6, I hadn't done anything, I'd never seen them, never been there before, probably between 6 and 12, started throwing stones at me. And that was a really enlightening position to be in.
Yep. Take that and turn it around again, and you get the what's happening to a lot of other people. Yeah. Anyone else? Yeah.
I was with my husband in Algiers earlier this year, and you get all these coffee shops and stands where you can have a drink, but never any women stuff. Well, we had walked a long time, and finally I said I was going to have a drink. And I stopped, and it was the strangest feeling, because the kids were laughing, the men were looking, and they were sort of whispering to each other, and it gave me the feeling, you know, I suddenly realized how it must feel to be different. It was just because it's such a Muslim country, you know,
that
just don't count.
Bunch of the tales in here of discrimination or suffering are women, by the way. I talked mainly about black-white kinds of stuff. But a woman who finds herself in a marriage that is oppressive, where she cannot be a full person, and has to first break out personally before, and then goes on to be politically active for other women or something like that. That's part.
I just had a short story.
Sure.
Growing up in, there's just not, in Nebraska, in the Midwest, especially when you get Nebraska, Wyoming, there's not a big black population in the Midwest. So there hasn't been a lot of exposure to it. And one time I went to Decatur, Illinois to visit a friend who had a woman friend. She was black, and didn't think nothing about it. We were going out, and we were doing a little bit of bar hopping. And we went to this one place, and I wanted to go in. It looked nice inside, and they both turned to me and said, "She can't go in there. They won't." And this was like only a year and a half ago, and I go, "What?
A year and a half ago? Really?"
Yeah, I couldn't believe it. I was just really taken back. And we did go in, and anyway, and all the heads turned. It made me take a couple steps back.
Yeah. Used to sometimes had send students to a church, big white church, and send one of the black students, black male student with one of the white female students, and then the rest of the students to sit toward the back, just to see what kind of you know, and there was never any, they were never turned away or anything like that, but just the looks and the stares and the nods and the and all that kind of stuff, and people buzzing and carrying on. Yeah. Anyone else want to share one, or, yeah?
Portion of memories I have of racism is I was in middle elementary school in Milwaukee, and I remember walking home from school to my all-white neighborhood and with a couple other kids, and there was a black lady waiting for a streetcar, and one of the kids said, and the others agreed, you know, what's that black lady doing in our neighborhood? You know, she shouldn't be there. She should get back to her own side of town. I still remember my revulsion.
Yeah. Yeah. I think a lot of us have had those experiences, and perhaps a little less common these days, and that's probably good, because some things have changed. And why have some things changed? Why?
Because people got involved.
That's right. That's right. Because people got out there and made them change. They don't change by themselves. If you don't do it, it isn't going to happen. Period. Yeah, in the first hymn. And then, oh, and you had your hand up too, didn't you? I'm sorry.
I was just going to share a story.
Yeah.
Years ago when I went to a duplex in Seattle, and there was a couple women in my household who were pretty socially active, more than I was. One was right out of college, and she decided to go downtown and to meet some people who were living on the streets and just kind of be with them and talk with them. And she ended up inviting one street person home and spent Easter with us. And she, this woman came with bags. She had all the clothes. She had encyclopedias in this one bag, and she had clothing in another bag. And she ended up staying in the room downstairs. It was kind of a spare room. And you'd go down there, and she'd be sitting with her coat over her head, reading an encyclopedia. And she just wasn't, you know, quite with it. But she was acting as if she were out in the rain, with the rain coming down, you know, kind of protecting herself. And she came upstairs, and she had Easter dinner with us, and she turned to be very intelligent. She had a lot of ideas about things in politics, or whatever, but she, I guess the story goes that she had been working for a department store as the person who was designing the windows, or the, the windows, or whatever. And she was fired, and something kind of devastating hit her about that. She got in a fight with a boss, and supposedly that was the beginning of her wanting to live on the street. And kind of, she was still designing street windows as she was doing. So anyway, when she left her home, she'd been there for like 2 nights, and she left a $20 bill.
She left a $20 bill? One of the things I want to claim on the work in political spirituality is, which is not the main topic for tonight, but is that that we are saved, and this could sound awful, and I have to try and nuance it just a tad, but there is a sense in which we are saved by the other. There is a sense in which we are saved by the poor. I am saved. You know, what am I? In part, I remain a racist, male, chauvinist to some extent, though I've worked on that stuff since the early 70s. Middle class, white person. When I am confronted with poverty, I am saved from some of my class bias. And I am reminded that the whole world is not like that. I am saved from my class ignorance. When I am confronted by someone who is black or Hispanic or Asian, whatever, and I have to deal with them as a real person and not as a stereotype or an epithet of some kind, I am saved from the racism inside myself. They deliver me from my racism. Now, I am not suggesting that poor people exist to save rich people from their classism, or that, you know, I really don't, that's not the case at all. But I do think that there is a sense in which, and there's a great Mayan story that I somewhere along the line in one of the sessions I'll read. But it's a story which kind of winds up where the rich, let's see, that the poor will account for the rich before the face of truth. That no one goes to heaven unless led by the hand of a poor person. And that's a very graphic being saved, in one sense, being saved by the poor, my accountability. You know, something you got from that woman is probably a whole lot more, you know, to you over time than maybe what she got out of that time. But she gave you a real gift. You wanted to say something.
I just recently graduated from a small college in Minnesota, and there's a project going on, I was going on for a number of years, connecting inner city high school students, mostly students of color, who wouldn't normally have an opportunity, basically financially, to attend college, any college. And basically what happens is a weekend a year, a busload or so, these high school students come up, visit campus, and are segregated. They eat in a different room, they attend sessions, and part of the sessions are they go to classes and stuff, but most of it is very segregated. And a group, about half a dozen, was walking down the hall of the student center one night after supper, and having a conversation amongst themselves. Another group of three, this is an upper class or upper middle class school, and a group of three people that all three of whom I knew, and all three who were from fairly affluent families, walked past, and I was walking behind this group a couple of 20, 30 feet, and as they passed them, their conversation changed, and I caught the phrase, something about it was probably the best meal they'd eaten, best food they'd had in days.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure I felt all four of those things all at once, all four of those feelings. And I didn't know what to do.
Yeah.
I just kept on going.
Yeah. Hang on to those experiences. They can be important to you. I mean, what you may do with it may be down the line yet a bit, but don't lose it. Don't lose it. It's part of who you are.
I had a good look at some of the effects of colonization in West Africa, taking a look at how people act, and one of the things that really stuck out in my mind is regularly how, for one thing, there were many of the blacks there who were in France and who fought in the war and in World War II, and also how many of them, upon seeing me, would immediately salute me as a white person. I mean, they'd come up and they'd greet me, and it was like, you know, like this. And for them, that was a normal way of greeting a French person. And during the times of colonization, and I was in a French country, and the way the French did treat those people and things, you know, if they ever stepped out of line, they were definitely in trouble.
Yeah.
And that is still carried over with these people today, and the way they viewed white people.
Yeah.
And you could still see it actually in the expatriates who were there, in their behavior and how they took on help and how they treated the blacks who were there. That was, you know, really still blatant discrimination still exists today. And if you look at the way West Africa was drawn, the country boundaries, countries like Togo have 49 languages, and it was just indiscriminately drawn, you know, against tribal lines and everything. That was all kind of eye-opening for me to see all that happen, and especially to have these old guys come up and salute me as a white person.
Very powerful. Very powerful kind of experience. Let me say a little bit about activation of commitment. This is not quite as dramatic, but what gets people off dead center? What gets them from, you know, having these kinds of experiences to doing something? One thing it seemed, and again, these things all seem kind of obvious. I don't think there's anything in here that's particularly new or startling. It's just I need to string them together as a set of beads so that they made sense to me. So they, one thing is a sense of personal effectiveness. That is to say, it has several dimensions. One dimension is, I actually can do something. It's the can do. Can do. I remember when my wife and I separated and I had the kids and I cooked my first Thanksgiving turkey. Okay? I mean, this is not social justice or anything, you know? But I had no idea that I could cook a Thanksgiving turkey and have it come out with stuffing and right and wonderful and good and all that kind of thing. I had this sort of sense of empowerment. I mean, it sounds kind of dumb, I know, but I had a sort of sense of empowerment. Hey, I can make a turkey too, you know? And I know a lot of the other way around, a lot of people who sometimes women, who've never changed the oil on a car, say, hey, I can change the oil on that sucker, you know, or whatever it may be. Well, the sense of personal effectiveness also applies in social justice. People need to have the feeling that they can do it. I mean, it's an amazing thing. I go place to place, and one of the forms of social justice, writing letters. Bread for the World has people write letters on bills that are pending before Congress. I did a talk at a community college in Texas. Two very dear friends of mine were in, it was a campus ministry setting. Two of my best friends were there, husband and wife, both have PhDs. Did this talk, talked about the legislation, said, okay, now we're going to write a letter. You know, ta-da. So I give them paper, I give them pens, and then I sort of watch what happens. And you know what they do? They start looking at each other's paper. And I thought, it was like the third grade. Here are these two people with PhDs trying to figure out, what do I say, you know? Well, it's not all that hard, you know? You say, dear Senator so-and-so, please support da-da-da-da. Sincerely yours, da. That's it, you know? I mean, if you want, you can give lots of reasons and go into all kinds of long stuff, but mostly they just count them anyhow. So, you know, if you want to write it 3 pages, you can do that, but that may not get you a whole lot. But that, just that sense of, hey, I can do it. And there's another sense of can do, and that's the sort of, that it matters. The sense of personal effectiveness. That it turns out that it affects something, effectiveness in that sense, not just the personal empowerment, but that it makes some kind of difference. A lot of organizations now, you can make a difference. Bread for the World says that on our t-shirts, you know, say it on our brochures. Why? Because people feel lost, right? I mean, you feel pretty powerless, right? You feel like, you know, I can't do that. I mean, I can't change that, you know? Sense of personal effectiveness. How long did women in this country work to get the vote? How long? How long? Don't know exactly when the suffragette movement started, but 40, 50, 60 years to get the vote. Just to get the vote, not to be president of the corporation, all the other stuff that goes with equality. Just to vote. Now, how long did the civil rights movement exist in America? How long? Yeah, 300-400 years. Yeah, 300-400 years in one form or another. Right? These things don't happen quickly, but you can make a difference. So it's people who have a sense of, Trudy Jackson is an activist, Bread for the World activist in Dallas. And they have a very conservative representative, Steve Bartlett, who voted against the WIC program. Now, I'm not going to take the time to explain, but it's a good program. It's for pregnant women and infants, It's a nutritional food supplement. It's a good program. It saves money. Helps for good nutrition during pregnancy and good nutrition for infants. He votes against it because he doesn't want to spend the money. So Trudy, she gets together a committee of three people and they go see Steve Bartlett. And he says, no, I'm not going to vote for the WIC program. So they go back the next year with a pediatrician. This time he knows they're coming, and he calls Bread for the World to find out what issues we're working on. And when they get there, he says, no, I'm not going to vote for it. And he's got reasons this time because he knows what they're coming to talk about. They went back a third year, and the third year he voted for the WIC voted for funds for the WIC program and co-sponsored the legislation. She ran into him at a candidate forum. He was running for office. He says, I recognize you. He says, what's your name? She says, I'm Trudy Jackson. He says, oh yeah, he says, you're with that Bread for the World group. You're the ones that changed my vote on WIC. It happens. In Seattle, Craig Fiarly over here. Well, I don't know which direction it is, over wherever it is, over there, okay. Craig Fiarly, he wrote a note and said he'd like to do something with Bread for the World, so I went out and I stayed there one night with him and we talked. And so he decided to have this little group. He'd get this little group going in Seattle. Now we have a couple of hundred members in Seattle, but how many people are going to show up for a meeting? How many people are actually going to do something? But Craig gets this meeting and he calls it together. They meet every month and they worship and they study and they write a letter. Well, last time I was there, the group consisted of Craig, his mother, his father, Sharon D'Amico, and John Terry, and Steve Fish. Okay, six people. That's pretty good, six people. And we got talking, and we said, you know, Representative John Miller over here is in the 1st Congressional District is not supporting this bill that Bread for the World's working on, the Harvest of Peace Resolution. Do you think you all could go see him during the August recess? Well, it happens John Terry used to work for the state college system, and he's done lobbying and stuff, so he really kind of knows how to do that stuff. They said, well, yeah, we think some of us could go. So John and Sharon and Craig went to see John Miller early August of this year. I mean, these are not makeup stories. These are things that happened in Seattle this August. They went in to see him. They show him the thing. He looks it over, and he says, yeah, I can support that. And he became a co-sponsor of the bill. Now, John Miller's on the Foreign Affairs Committee. His co-sponsorship is very important to the passage of that bill. It's because people have these experiences that make them feel like, hey, I really did something. It made a difference. Did it pass? No, it didn't pass. You don't win them all, and you don't win them in a short time. But there's that sense of, gosh, if we hadn't gone to visit him, you know, if we hadn't written those letters, he wouldn't have signed on to the bill. So that sense of personal effectiveness, in addition, a sense of personal responsibility. I guess that's the phrase I would use is this is sort of can do. This is sort of a sort of sense of, if I don't do it, nobody will. I've had the experience, and you have too, and lots of the people I talked to had the experience of waiting for someone else to get something going, whatever it was you thought needed to get going, okay? And you sit around and you say, well, somebody will do it, you know, or somebody is doing it, surely. And then one day you say to yourself, maybe I'm the somebody. You know, and you all of a sudden realize that it comes to you, and not as guilt. This is not guilt tripping. This is just suddenly, hey, if I don't do it, why should I expect somebody else to do it? You know? Why do we think someone else is going to? It's my responsibility to do it. I have the opportunity. I have the responsibility to bring peace, to make justice, to work for a renewable a sustainable, not only a sustainable, but a renewable earth. That sense that if I don't do it, nobody will do it. The decision to become involved is usually not a rational, well-thought-out decision. It's usually a spontaneous thing. It's like if you read different studies, for example, somebody leaps into a river to save somebody else. They haven't sat in the boat and thought about it a long time. There's just that sudden feeling, I've got to do something about this. And it's more a feeling than a thought. There is a thought accompanied. I mean, the thought is, I need to leap in the river. I mean, it's not a completely non-cognitive act. But it is a kind of compulsion almost. It just kind of wells up in you. And that feeling, I've got, me personally, I've got to do something about this. Margaret Sanger, when she was a nurse, the example I used for that was from Margaret Sanger's autobiography. And I just read a very short section of it. Okay, she has gone to, there's this Mrs. Sachs, S-A-C-H-S, who's a 28-year-old woman who has septicemia as a result of a self-induced abortion. Mrs. Sachs narrowly survived this septicemia with the help of Margaret Sanger and the doctor and her husband. And the doctor says, if you get pregnant again, you know, this could kill you. She already had a couple of kids, and now she's had this mishap. And she says to the doctor, you know, tell me what I can do. This is sort of pre-birth control, Margaret Sanger's work. Tell me what I can do. And the doctor says to her, tell Jake to sleep on the roof. Big help. This is a lot of help, right? And she turns to Margaret Sanger, and she says, please tell me the secret, and I'll never breathe it to a soul. Please. Well, she was haunted by that, but she didn't do anything. And then 3 months later, Jake called. Mrs. Sachs had again become pregnant, aborted, and had an infection. And this is what Margaret Sanger writes in her autobiography. For a wild moment, I thought of sending someone else. But actually, of course, I hurried into my uniform, caught up my bag, and started out. All the way, I longed for a subway wreck, an explosion, anything to keep me from having to enter that home again. But nothing happened, even to delay me. I turned into the dingy doorway and climbed the familiar stairs once more. The children were there, young little things. Mrs. Sachs was in a coma and died within 10 minutes. I folded her still hands across her breast, remembering how they had pleaded with me, begging so humbly for the knowledge which was her right. I drew a sheet over her pallid face. Jake was sobbing, running his hands through his hair and pulling it out like an insane person. Over and over again he wailed, my God, my God, my God. And so then she walks the streets for a while, and then she says, the scenes piled one upon another, I could bear it no longer. As I stood there, the darkness faded. The sun came up and threw its reflection over the housetops. It was the dawn of a new day in my life also. The doubt and questioning, the experimenting and trying were now to be put behind me. I knew I could not go back merely to keeping people alive. I went to bed knowing that no matter what it might cost, I was finished with palliatives and superficial cures. I was resolved to seek out the root of evil, to do something to change the destiny of mothers whose miseries were as vast as the skies. And that led her then to her great, enormous work in behalf of birth control and so forth to try and make that available to people. Well, I could go on a bit and would like to have you share some more stories, but I want to be faithful to the hour and close at 8:30. And then, you know, if some of you want to sit around and chit-chat some more, that's fine. Those of you who need to get on will be free to do it. I do want to share, as a closing item with you, obviously there are a lot of things I'd like to do, but a poem by Marge Piercy. It is one of my favorite poems. Found it on a calendar. I don't know what book of Marge Piercy it is in. I've looked at a number of books of poetry, and I don't see it in the books, but it had her name on it. And it sounds like something she would have written. She writes, do you know Marge Piercy? Woman on the Edge of Time, lot of fine books and poetry, 12 spoke wheel flashing and so forth. Anyhow. What can they do to you? Whatever they want. They can set you up. They can bust you. They can break your fingers. They can burn your brain with electricity, blur you with drugs till you can't walk, can't remember. They can take your child, wall up your lover. They can do anything. You can't stop them from doing. How can you stop them? Alone, you can fight. You can refuse. You can take whatever revenge you can, but they roll over you again. But two people fighting back to back can cut through a mob. A snake dancing file can break a cordon. An army can beat an army. Two people can keep each other sane, can give support, conviction, love, massage, hope, sex. Three people are a delegation, a committee, a wedge. With four, you can play bridge and start an organization. With six, you can rent a whole house, eat pie for dinner with no seconds, and hold a fundraising party. A dozen makes a demonstration, 100 fill a hall, 1,000 have solidarity and your own newsletter, 10,000 power and your own paper, 100,000 your own media, 10 million your own country. It goes on one at a time. It starts when you care to act. It starts when you do it again after they said no. It starts when you say we and you know who you mean, and each day you mean one more.